Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Schmidt, Judge Reyes, Judge Cochran, the Honorable John P. Schmidt presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have three cases, sort of four cases on argument today. Today is June 18th. The first case is Sinnott versus Sinnott. Please correct me if that's not correct. All right, great. A24-1761. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes and then you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. The podium does adjust, so feel free to get it up to the whatever height you want it to and get settled in before you begin. And counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes for your argument as well. Counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Adam Galili. I represent the appellant John Sinnott in the matter. Mr. Sinnott is respectfully requesting that this court reverse and remand the district court's order denying his request for modification of maintenance, reverse the sequestration of Mr. Sinnott's marital lien, and vacate the award of conduct-based attorney's fees. The court is very familiar with the facts of the case, and what I'd like to focus on is a few of the larger issues and respond to a few issues raised in respondent's brief. Your Honors, the three main issues that I believe is before the court is, number one, the court's failure to modify maintenance. There were two questions the district court had to answer here. Has there been a change of circumstances? And if so, is the current order unreasonable or unfair under the circumstances? We respectfully suggest that both should have been answered affirmatively. In summary, working backwards, the court's order finds that wife is short approximately $500 on her budget. That's based on the court's own findings.
But doesn't that take into account her gross income, not her net income?
Your Honor, it was a great question. The court did not discuss her net income, which is an issue in the matter. However, respondents suggest that if we look at her pay stub, we can calculate what her net take-home pay is. That's not an accurate reflection of her total yearly net income. People hold more than they should or they hold less. Sometimes they get refunds, sometimes they don't. That's why we look at the tax returns to generally see what was the total paid throughout the year.
So your argument is that the gross income is the finding made by the district court, so that's the number that should be considered?
That's the only number I believe we can consider. Otherwise, we'd be doing guesswork on what the net income would be.
Thank you.
Here, Your Honors, very simply, wife is short $500 on her budget, yet the district court kept an order for $1,800 a month, more than three times what wife's need was. In a situation like this, when you have such a discrepancy, there usually is some sort of justification. But that justification is found nowhere in the court's findings of fact. There was no question.
But the district court has to find that there is a substantial change of circumstances before modifying it. So the district court here just kept the maintenance at the same amount, correct?
They did keep the maintenance at the same amount. It is a little confusing whether the district court found there was a change in circumstances.
Well, I think the district court did clearly say that father did not show that there are changes of circumstances based on his income and based on her income and expenses.
I believe, Your Honor, yes, I to some extent I do agree with that, but what the court should have found that husband's income, in my estimation, was less of an issue. The issues that were in front of the court was wife's income and her expenses. Have those changed since the time of the judgment and decree? And then husband's second argument was his expenses have gone up since the time of the judgment and decree. Our position is any one of those three would be enough for the court to find a change of circumstances. If we look at wife's income, it more than doubled. If we look at her monthly living expenses, they're about the same as they were at the time of the divorce. And so her need has substantially changed. If we compare the findings of fact in the divorce decree, many of the findings suggest that wife will not be able to work full time, that there's no expectation that wife will have the physical ability to work those kind of hours or increase her income. We fast forward 7 years later at the circumstances and time now, wife is in fact working full time and wife has in fact significantly increased her income. Those alone are enough to find there's been a change in circumstances since the time of the judgment and decree and now.
Counsel, I'm not sure if that's enough, because even if somebody's income changes, if their expenses increase as well, and what you have is a net loss, I'm not sure case law says that just the rise in income itself can be a change of circumstances. It has to be, don't we have to, and I think that goes back to your original argument of how do we know exactly what her net expenses were? I mean, don't we need to really look at that change there?
Yes, Your Honor, I 100% agree with you, which is our position is that the court's finding of fact on her budget is there. It finds her budget to be approximately $4,000 a month. Now, if we compare her budget of $4,000 a month to her income that the court has found, at least the gross income that we have, there's only a deficit of $500. At the time of the judgment decree, there was a deficit of over $2,200, albeit about $400 of it was child support. So we have a situation where at the time of the judgment decree, she needs more than $1,800. The court orders it. Now she needs about $500, but the court holds the order of $1,800 in place. And we believe that the combination of the expenses and her income, correctly pointed out by the court, in this specific case, show the math that $1,800 just doesn't seem right. There's no justification for more than three times what wife's shortfall is.
Right, but I think that's actually, and I appreciate that summary that you provided. The issue though isn't the issue of whether or not, like you pointed out, there's a substantial change of circumstances. And if the district court doesn't find there's a substantial change of circumstances, then there's no need to change the maintenance, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And again, here, I don't know what other facts you would have in a situation where the court has previously said wife can't work. We don't believe that wife will be able to work in the future. And now we come back and in fact, wife is working in the future and she's working full time and she's earning more than twice what she was earning before. There's arguments as to what her income was. Husband wanted her income to be a little higher. Wife wanted her income to be actually even a little higher than what the court had suggested. But whatever that income range is, we're talking about a difference of, you know, $400 to $700 a month. We're not talking about $1,800. And again, if the court were going to go that route, the court should have illustrated so in its order. There's just no formula to figure out how the court arrived at its math. I will say that I think respondent had suggested in his brief, when it comes to appellant's expenses, that the court, our contention was that the court reduced his budget by over $1,600 with no explanation. There was no discussion about it on the transcript. There was no request in the arguments for husband's expense that suggested husband's expenses were somehow inflated. But what respondent suggested in his brief was that the court looked at my client's budget, the appellant's budget at the time of the divorce decree, credited him $500 for rent, and added the lease that was provided in his affidavit. Well, if the court did that, we have a problem, because the court is supposed to look at the circumstances here and now, his current budget, not his budget at the time of the judgment and decree. So if the court, in fact, reduced his income, it reduced his expenses, according to the math that respondent provided, that means the court did not look at his current expenses. They looked at his expenses 7 years ago on the divorce decree, which I believe would be an error.
At the district court, wife's circumstances weren't the only reason that husband was asking for modification. It was also based on husband's argument that he doesn't have a present ability to pay.
Correct, Your Honor.
Are you still making that argument?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, and so how do we get over that credibility finding?
Well, Your Honor, I think the issue of credibility is one issue, but the court has to look at the facts here and now. And so, again, with the issue of the budget, if the court had said, we looked at husband's budget now, husband's budget seems inflated, husband's not credible because of A, B, C, and D, there would be an argument perhaps along those lines. But none of that is present here. And in fact, the opposite. When we come to wife's budget, there are several paragraphs dedicated as to the corrections made in wife's budget, reduced her budget by approximately $200. Several paragraphs of the court's order were committed to explaining that. Not one sentence was committed to explaining why the court reduced his income by over his expenses by over $1,600.
So is it your view that it's necessary for us to remand to the district court to make additional findings rather than reverse?
Your Honor, I do believe a remand is necessary for additional findings, but I do believe a reversal on the finding that there's no change of circumstances is perhaps appropriate prima facie based on the findings of the court on her income.
Well, if we were to remand, the district court could make findings as to net income, which is really a more relevant consideration. I think you would agree.
Yes, Your Honor. And just to finish on that point, again, several paragraphs discuss wife's budget reduction by $200, none committed to husband's budget. Husband's budget's an issue. If husband doesn't have the ability to pay, that's the second prong of maintenance. Credibility aside, the court has to look at his current circumstances, not his past credibility issues. What's his reasonable monthly expenses now? Husband could be the most, and I'm not by any way suggesting my client is, but in a extreme case, the husband can be the most contempt person the court's had in front of him, the most dishonest. But if the facts presented show this is his budget, here are the receipts, the court has to look at those facts, setting aside issues about his character.
But there's also issues about not being candid, intentionally omitting tax returns, misrepresenting earning potential. I mean, there's a lot more than just not credible. There's a number of findings that husband is hiding and not paying.
Your Honor, I would respectfully suggest many of those findings are from the judgment and decree. There was, if the court looks at the transcript in this case, there is no, this wasn't about husband's credit. All the credibility issues came to the issues of arrears, that spousal maintenance hadn't been paid. The 2022 taxes, I tried to explain in my client's affidavit to the district court memorandum, that was disclosed to opposing counsel in discovery. I mean, then this ties to the issue of conduct-based attorney fees. Discovery was served, discovery was answered. There was not one deficiency letter. There was not one conference call with the court on discovery. There was not one issue raised in the transcript about documents not being disclosed. The 22 taxes were disclosed by wife because husband turned that over to wife in formal discovery. The reason it wasn't introduced in his affidavit because we didn't believe it was relevant at that point. The prior tax years, 17, 18, 19, 20, and 21, all dealt with the spousal maintenance arrears, trying to calculate what the arrears were. That's why those were introduced to the court. Some of his tax returns showed spousal maintenance credit because it was a taxable deduction for him. 23 and his 24 income were provided because that was relevant to his current circumstances here and now. We didn't provide 22 because it wasn't relevant. But again, Your Honor, the difference there is he's claiming his income was $66,000. They're suggesting it's $72,000. That's a, you know, $6,000 difference gross. So we're talking about $300 to $500 a month best net income. Based on that, the court ordered him to pay $11,000 plus in conduct-based attorney fees. And so we suggest he provided his here and now income. And even if we were going to argue he's trying to hide income, the $6,000 wouldn't make much of a difference in the end calculation. And so to us, that doesn't add up. The last point on maintenance is, on conduct-based attorney fees is that I do believe the statute at the time, our understanding was that, regardless, I understand the statute was modified. The conduct discussed in the attorney fees is not conduct now, absent the discussion on the 22 taxes. We've already said that all discovery was disclosed. There was never one discovery issue in this case. And so that can't be a basis of conduct-based attorney fees. The arrears were paid. In the current situation, wife actually owes husband money, not vice versa. And so if we're going to punish him for not paying arrears, that should have been more specified in the court. They're punishing him based on past conduct and not current conduct in this litigation. Your Honors, very briefly, on the marital lien issue, I would just ask the court to consider this. The money that wife owes husband was secured via marital lien. That marital lien is not worth anything until wife pays the money. The court in this situation ordered something to be sequestered, which doesn't exist. This $30,000 plus that's owed to husband is not fungible commodity right now. It's not sitting in a bank account. It's tied to the house that wife is living in. As the courts asked my client to sign over title to that house, wife needs to pay that marital lien, and then the money can be sequestered. That's how a sequestration should work. Otherwise, my client would be forever barred from receiving these funds. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes on rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, go ahead and get settled in and you'll have 15 minutes. You may begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. It's always an honor to be before this court. Like my esteemed colleague, I'm not just going to start rereading my. We've tried to argue that as well as you could, and I know the court will have questions, and I think counsel really did hit some of the areas that we need to discuss. But I would like to say. That while we're talking about significant changes in circumstances, we also have to be mindful of that second prong, which is, did the court find that change to make the existing award unreasonable and unfair? And I think under the facts of this case, we really have to look at that. I don't think that's been argued much. And what I mean by that is, you know, there was a lot of talk about my client's budget now being $4,000 a month.
And counsel, can I ask, I'm sorry, yes. At the outset, you didn't identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
My apologies. My name is Tim Lees, L-E-E-S, I've been Kelly Sinnott, now Erickson's lawyer, since about 2016. I took it on as a Tubman case. But when we talk about, well, there's only a $500 deficit, you take her gross income and the expenses of $4,000, but there's more to that $4,000 budget than what's being discussed. The court was very clear that because Mr. Sinnott for 7 years has never made a voluntary payment, and that means absolutely no payments of $1,800 for the last 5 years, that puts significant financial hardship on my client. My client had to reduce her budget. She had to keep that budget down, and the court says, look, she's living below the marital standard of living. And that marital standard of living is always the baseline, which we have to go back to. That baseline, in this case, established in the judgment and decree. If we take that standard of living in the judgment decree, and which was 4309, and we don't adjust that for any cost of living increases, and while the court didn't make findings, we did provide evidence showing that if by the consumer price index for Minneapolis and the metro area, if we applied inflation to that, a cost of living, that budget would now be up to $5,400. But I'm saying if you just take her marital standard of living to which she's entitled, the 4309, and I will get to her net income, but taking her net income of 2483, that's still a need of $1,826. So I don't think it's fair or just that an obligor, by refusing to comply with a court order year after year after year, can force an obligee into financial hardship and then come into court and capitalize on that because they were responsible enough to try to reduce their budget and not live on credit and not keep their budget huge. I think when we talk about unreasonableness and unfairness, that has to be recognized. She's not at the standard of living she was at the time of the divorce. And so the analysis isn't as simple as take her expenses, subtract her, take her current, what I call her survival mode budget, reduce that by her gross monthly income, and all we have is a deficit of $500. I don't think that's an intellectually sound argument. With regard to Mr. Sinnott's budget, which—
Excuse me, are the district court's findings sufficiently detailed to support the reduction in Mr. Sinnott's expenses?
Yes, thank you. And that's exactly where I was
going
to go.
And relatedly, you suggest we should consider the net income, but it doesn't appear the district court made a finding on net income. So I'm wondering, do we need to remand for additional findings on both points?
If I may, I would like to take the expenses first, and then we'll move to the income. No, this was Mr. Sinnott's burden to come before the court with proof, with evidence, to support his claim. His claim was this long list of items I say I'm spending every month totals this. The only evidence beyond his self-created and supported only by his testimony, the only actual evidence was the increase in his housing expenses, his rent. That is the only evidence there was for the court to consider. Now, I understand in many, many, many divorce cases, we often don't provide evidence or statements for every single utility or this or that. But this is different because there are extensive findings as to his credibility. And you can't say, well, sure, the court found him non-credible and dishonest and on this issue, but the court should have believed him on his expenses. So to answer your question, Your Honor, no, it doesn't need to be remanded. He's had his bite at the apple. He's had his opportunity to come to court to provide utility statements, to provide whatever, car payment notes, installment payments, whatever. He chose not to do that. And we don't believe that his testimony is credible based on multiple findings of the court in several different areas, including the fact that, I think it was early on, let me say, I don't want to get caught up with the wrong date, but once income withholding went into place, Mr. Sinnott quit his job with the U.S. Postal Service, moved across the country. My client didn't even know where he was until around 2022, as described in her affidavit. So this isn't just someone that's kind of a technical lie. No, he has gone to great lengths to avoid paying his spousal maintenance obligation. And the financial situation we're in today would have, I submit, been completely different, and the burden would have been on her had he complied and done his duty. But I don't think there was any obligation on the court to just accept his word on what those expenses are. And that is really one area that it's my understanding from case law that the Court of Appeals is not going to now go in and second guess whether this court properly found Mr. Sinnott to not be credible. Credibility is the trial court's domain. Your Honor, on the income issue, and we were candid in our brief, there's an issue here. And I provided you with the Schmidt case. And there was another case at that time, the Walker case, which was also my case with the same issue. So a couple of these came out at the same time. And that in Schmidt, it was reversed because the court did not make a finding of net income. Preliminarily, I would like to say it is the net income readily and accurately discernible from the same exhibit that we know the court looked at in determining what her gross income was. The gross income found by the court is exactly the same as, and I call it Exhibit 5, that's at index number 84 at page 45. But that says exactly what her gross salary is. And the court said it was a 40-hour a week is what he was basing it on. It gives the gross. And so we know the court reviewed and considered that exhibit. We do believe that Schmidt is distinguishable from the instant case. In Schmidt, the whole issue of whether or not she was even entitled to maintenance depended on that income calculation. And what the court said was, well, there was information in the record of what she would likely pay in taxes. So I submit there was still speculation in that case as to what the actual taxes and withholding would be. But in the instant case, the taxes and withholdings from her gross income are not speculative. Exhibit 5 shows exactly what is deducted from her gross in exact amounts, what she's paying for federal and state taxes, Social Security, Medicare, retirement, insurance. So the court did not have to speculate as to that net income. Now, I'm sure the question is, okay, but why isn't there that finding then? So we have that number. And I can't answer that. And as a matter of practice, as practitioners, we talk about this. Courts keep coming out with these maintenance orders without specific net income findings, and it's problematic in most cases. But I would submit to this court that remanding for that calculation, which is readily evident with accurate numbers from an exhibit we know the court considered and looked at, really doesn't further justice in any way. And it's not gonna, I believe, substantively change any of the court's decisions in this case. Your Honor, have I answered your question?
Yes,
I'm not answering if I answered it.
No, you've answered
sufficiently,
it well.
But
yes, thank you.
Okay.
Counsel, I have a question about the
yes, sir.
Sequestering the money. So your opposing counsel makes an argument that that money doesn't exist because it's tied up in the house and that the wife first has to pay some money and then it can be sequestered. So what's your response to that?
First of all, I disagree with the whole notion that his lien in the property is not a lienable property interest. And I would note that, and I don't mean any disrespect to my colleague, but there is no legal argument from him on this issue. No case law saying that, hey, a marital lien, that's not a property interest. To the contrary, what we provided you with in our brief is case law that says A marital lien is property. It is personal property. And when we look at 518A.71, a personal property interest, his personal estate, is subject to a lien. I'm hard-pressed to believe that the true remedy in this case would be for my client to, and I forget the exact number, if I could say 23,000 just for example. If the argument is truly she needs to gather 23,000 and pay those funds to Mr. Sinnott, and then she can now go try to chase those funds and ask that they be sequestered. I don't think, number one, we have a historical record here that suggests that's going to be a reliable thing for her at all. This lien, I think what the court foresaw here was he hasn't voluntarily paid in 7 years, and I don't think it looked likely that he was going to start paying. So every month since then, and I'm not going to get into anything that's happened since, but if he hasn't paid anything up till now, that lien keeps going down and down and down.
Counsel, I have a quick question for you on attorney fees.
The district
court decided that that need-based fees were not appropriate, but conduct-based fees were. Isn't that decision internally inconsistent by the district court? And if not, why not?
Denied need-based? Could you restate your question? I apologize.
Right. The district court, if I recall correctly, granted the conduct-based attorney fee request.
Correct.
But denied the need-based.
Correct.
Isn't that internally inconsistent? If not, why not?
Oh, not at all internally inconsistent. Need-based attorney's fees are truly, that has nothing to do with how people behave. People could be angels in court, and the court could still say, well, she doesn't have the income to pay her fees. He does, so we're going to have him contribute. That's one prong of the basis for awarding attorney's fees. The second is conduct-based. They're completely separate animals. If someone has caused this matter to be significantly and unreasonably more expensive than it should have been, then the court can award attorney's fees under the guise that it was unfair and unnecessary for this litigant to have to pay all these fees to deal with this malfeasance, for lack of a better word, in thinking quickly. So I tried to brief that fairly well. We believe that the conduct in this case absolutely falls under conduct for which the court can, again, all the dishonesty, the discovery issues, which there were exhibits on and argued in our proposed order to the court, and the fact that but for Mr. Sinnott's absolute refusal to follow the law, the court order, Ms. Sinnott wouldn't have had to bring any collection or enforcement actions. Your Honors, I see my time is up. Unless there's anything further.
I'm not seeing any other questions. Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for Appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, both parties came to this court in somewhat contempt. I'm not saying in contempt of court, but both of them violated the court order. One didn't pay maintenance. The other one didn't pay a lien that expired. Now, if you were going to argue the lien wasn't paid because maintenance wasn't paid, so one's more at fault than the other, okay. But wife never brought a motion to relieve her obligation of this lien in 2022 when it was due. It was husband that brought this motion to the court asking for modification of maintenance, asking that the lien be reduced by the amount he owes in arrears. And so when we look at the conduct-based attorney's fees, it was husband that brought this motion initially. Wife was in violation of the court order as well. And again, had wife wanted to relieve herself of that obligation, she could have done so in 2022. The reason I bring this up is because the district court makes many findings regarding my client's conduct, the fact that he didn't pay these expenses, the fact that he ignored the court order, but somewhat true of wife's actions as well. Wife had enforcement mechanisms. She could have done so, but she didn't enforce those.
Wouldn't that require us to weigh her credibility based on these proceedings?
To some extent, yeah. I think based on the proceedings currently in front of the court, not necessarily based on the time at the judgment and decree.
But that's not something that, as an appellate court, that we do. We don't really weigh witness or parties' credibility. We have to defer to what the trial court did here, and the trial court didn't make any credibility findings against wife, saying she was not credible or she's at fault.
I think that's a fair point, Your Honor. Again, I guess with the conduct-based fees, I turn to what specific conduct did the court cite here from the current litigation, not stuff from the judgment and decree. Non-payment of arrears, if that was the issue, if it was husband violated the order, wife had to incur fees in order to bring action to hold husband in contempt, that's not accurate because husband brought the motion and husband's motion requested that the arrears be credited against the marital lien.
Does it really matter how the issue is brought to the court? Once the issue is raised to the court, you can decide it based on the record, correct?
I would agree, Your Honor. If husband had at the time said, no, I don't owe arrears, and proceeded through depositions and discovery and increasing the cost of attorney fees and expenses unnecessarily, then I would agree. But none of that happened here. Husband acquiesced and agreed. Husband himself said this is how that this should be credited. And there was no evidence cited on the record or in the court's order that the litigation was in any way made longer or more unnecessarily expensive because of husband's conduct. The argument seems to be that it's because husband didn't pay that wife had to bring her motion in response to his, and she should be entitled to fees incurred for those. But the statute talks about unnecessarily increasing the costs of expense in litigation, which I respectfully suggest did not happen in this case.
Well, isn't the expenses to wife increased by the mere fact that he never paid any maintenance fees whatsoever, and he's the one who raised this issue in court, which forced her to incur expenses by having to go to court to, you know, get her monies that were due to her?
That could be an argument, Your Honor, but I think the court would have to find some specific findings on that because, again, husband said, I owe wife this money, the arrears. That would have been the issue for wife. He had a right to bring a request to modify his maintenance. I don't think it's fair to say that because he brought a request to modify maintenance, conduct-based attorney fees. If the conduct is the arrears issue that he never paid, the court should have specified that we're punishing him for not paying the arrears, which I don't think would be appropriate under the statute.
But the district court did also make findings on the fact that it was husband's burden to produce evidence as to his expenses, et cetera, and didn't meet that burden, which is why it also denied the request on the merits.
Your Honor, respectfully, I don't read the court's order to say that we looked at husband's expenses, find it to be not credible, and therefore reduce it by $1,621. I don't find that in the order.
The district court did, if I recall correctly, I think the district court did make some extensive credibility determinations with respect to husband as to the lack of credibility.
As to his income, I believe, but not to any issues related to his expenses, as far as I recall, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors. I see my time.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments today. It was very well argued, very well briefed. The case is submitted, and we'll get an opinion out within a statutory time frame. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.